The living of diocese in Airport Da Nang is 350 times higher than living in USA.
Most worrisome, dioxin levels in people living near Da Nang exceed internationally accepted limits by as much as 100-fold. They reportedly suffer cardiovascular and immune disorders, and their babies are more often deformed. A cleanup is planned, and it will be costly. The United States has shared military data and provided technical assistance. Last May, it offered $3 million. Dr. Son says billions will be needed to clean up the dioxin and to treat Vietnamese health victims of U.S. herbicide spraying. According to U.S. researchers, between 2 and 5 million Vietnamese were exposed to dioxin-laced herbicide during the war. Congenital birth defects persist to this day, Vietnamese health officials say, and caring for the disabled is a major drain on the economy.
Yeah, 3 million is not so big, but I think so that it's a good first step in long way ahead. Maybe in this year, 3, and next year, 10 times more than that. I hope so.
There were initially 4 dioxin hotspots across southern Vietnam, former U.S. air bases at Da Nang, Bien Hoa, and Phu Cat, where Agent Orange was stored in drums and loaded onto planes, and sections of the Alue Valley near the border with Laos. Cleanup at Da Nang was completed in 2018. In late 2022, the U.S. government allocated $29 million to begin cleaning up a mess 4 times that size at Bien Hoa. The complete job is expected to cost $500 million and take a decade to complete. Meanwhile, the effects of the American war have transcended generations. Read more about this at greenplanetmonitor.net and subscribe for as little as $5 a month. You'll be helping to make this weekly news package happen. Transformed the surface of the Earth geologically. Dutch chemist Paul Crutzen captured this idea in a single word, the Anthropocene, this past July in Lille, France. A scientific panel announced its own definition of the Anthropocene, when it began, how Earth's new time unit should be ranked in the geological time scale, and where humanity's signature is best observed in Earth's sediments as a reference standard for other spots of the same age around the world. The panel's choice for that one spot, a small lake in southern Ontario, its key human signature, radioactive plutonium from atmospheric thermonuclear tests that peaked in the mid-1950s. This coming fall, the panel will present a detailed proposal to the body that commissioned it. Jan Zalasiewicz was the first chair of the Anthropocene Working Group. I reached him near Leicester in the UK. This is a huge body of science at the Anthropocene Working Group, and it's the various teams working alongside it, like originally a dozen candidate sites for that golden spike with, you know, who knows how many scientists, researchers, technicians within each group. Crawford Lake, Ontario ended up winning. But lots of science. So whatever happens as the proposal moves up the geo-bureaucratic hierarchy, maybe it'll get rejected. We can talk more about that later. But whatever happens, there's all this science that's been produced.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I mean, and it's terrific. Crawford Lake is magnificent, but there were also other magnificent candidates in there. I mean, it was really an embarrassment of riches by the time these, you know, the various teams working on the various sites, which were candidates, had finished working the data. You know, to paraphrase Paul Crutzen, who once made an aside about the Anthropocene, you know, he realized it was serious, but he said, the science is beautiful. And in this case, the science is terrific, whether it's, you know, from an estuary in Japan or a peat bog in Poland, you know, or an ice core in Antarctica, all of these, and put together so quickly.
And this crater lake in China, Sihai Longwan Crater Lake in,
yes,
in China, which I've seen pictures of, it's gorgeous, it's totally isolated, is the perfect place to collect airborne things coming down.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's a beautiful lake and beautiful science, you know, and you know, all of the characters, if you like, the Anthropocene, you know, come through loud and clear at Sihai Longwan, and, you know, as they do at Beppu Bay and Searsville Reservoir, and of course Crawford Lake, you know. So all of those will add to, contribute to the story, to the picture. These sites in themselves, they represent, you know, a story that is building up all over the world, you know, of changed environmental conditions, which are leading to changing geological signals in deposits of sediment and rock everywhere.
Tell me how it began. Go back, Jan Zelisiewicz, and recall for us how it all began in 2009. If I understand correctly, Phil Gibbard, who was also on the SQS at the time, asked you to, or suggested to you, that you set up a working group?
Yes, precisely. Yeah, I mean, Phil was then the SQS chair, and that arose out of the first, if you like, geological examination of Paul Crutzen's Anthropocene concept, which had been growing, developing, you know, in the Earth system science community, you know, as if it was a real geological time unit, you know. But of course, you know, it had gone through none of the barriers and hurdles and examinations, you know, that a timescale unit should do. So in 2006, you know, colleagues and I on the Stratigraphic Commission of the Geological Society of London, we mulled over, you know, this new word and this new idea, and we wrote a short paper, you know, for a journal of the Geological Society of America, you know, suggesting there might be something to it, you know, it might be geologically real. And that came out in 2008. And as part of the fallout, you know, from that, then Phil, you know, asked, you know, me and my colleagues to set up a formal group, you know, the Anthropocene Working Group, to examine the case properly and, if the evidence warranted, to make a formal proposal.
Now, run through the steps for me briefly, for those who don't know anything about this. There were three things you had to figure out: geological reality, timing, and rank. So let's talk about these in turn, like geological reality. What was the geological reality of the proposed Anthropocene? What do we mean by that?
That you have characters or signals or tracers, you know, within layers of sediment, layers of mud, layers of sand, layers of peat in a peat bog, that kind of thing. Like fossils, like chemical signals, you know, pesticides and things like that, which make those strata distinctive and which make one infer that those strata were deposited within an environment, you know, a local and or global environment that was also distinctive and different from previous times. And we spent several years gathering this evidence because at the beginning it wasn't really clear. You know, we'd kind of paraphrased Paul Crutzen to say that, you know, well, the chemistry of the atmosphere seemed to be changing, the chemistry of the oceans was changing, you know, with burning fossil fuels. The landscape was changing, you know, because of the ways that people were, you know, building dams and building cities, indeed. But at first it wasn't clear that this was anything very distinctive, very characteristic, because of course, you know, we're all aware of, you know, that humans have been changing the landscape for thousands of years. You know, we have the pyramids, we have the Great Wall of China, we have the evidence of early farming and all of this. The big question early on was, are we just seeing a little bit more of the same? But then, of course, looking at the evidence closely, it you know, the Anthropocene did turn out to be special. Firstly, because of this speed and scale of the change, you know, the amount of carbon being ejected, expelled into the atmosphere by fossil fuel burning was, you know, an extraordinary rate, 100 times faster than the carbon dioxide change at the end of the last ice age, for instance. And that in itself was pretty fast, geologically speaking. And then a whole lot of signals appeared, which, you know, things like, you know, people were becoming aware that plastics, you know, first really manufactured from the mid-20th century, were being found everywhere. They were being found in soils, in sediments at the bottom of the sea, you know, in Arctic ice, on the mountaintops. Other signals came through. Little particles of fly ash, little particles of unburnt carbon from industrial burning, again, of fossil fuels.
Spheroidal carbonaceous particles.
Indeed, or SPCs, as they're known in the trade, yes. And this is, you know, terrific work done by Neil Rose, you know, who became a key figure in providing data and becoming a member, indeed, of the Anthropocene Working Group.
And nitrogen and phosphorus.
Yes, both of these doubled, and phosphorus is a difficult signal because it has no isotopes. You can only use, you know, the raw amounts in soils, which is very variable. But nitrogen has got a couple of isotopes, you know, and using those, you can track the increase in nitrogen, you know, even in lakes very far from agriculture. Up in the far north of Canada, there is a signal of nitrogen, you know, in the uppermost layers in lakes to say that something different is happening here.
So you established that the Anthropocene had a geological reality.
Yes.
You could observe human signals in the sediments.
You could observe human signals in the sediment, and commonly in sediments in all kinds of places, you know, so whether it's in at the bottom of the sea, or it's in lake beds, you know, or peat bogs, or indeed even in little layers of lime on growing stalagmites, you know, that you could still see the signals of the Anthropocene.
Okay, so then there was the question of timing. When did the Anthropocene begin? You were looking at the mid-20th century. You thought it began on July 16th, 1945, with the explosion of the detonation of J. Robert Oppenheimer's Trinity bomb in Alamogordo.
Well, even before that, you know, there was a wider question of where. Initially, as with Paul Crutzen, we thought the big changes are really driven by industrialization. And therefore, it seemed sensible, you know, to take the start of industrialization, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you know, James Watt's steam engine and so forth, and say, OK, here's a beginning. And really, that was, you know, for a couple of years, that was our first thought. But it didn't work, not geologically, because the signals were too slow in starting. You know, the initial liftoff of carbon dioxide, you know, was very slow, you know, within, you know, the Victorian dark satanic mills and so forth. And also they were patchily scattered around the Earth. It, you know, it started in Europe, you know, then spread to, you know, North America, then later on, you know, to Asia and so forth. So it was a messy signal. Whereas once we began to look at the mid-20th century, building on this idea, you know, which again started in the Earth System Science community with Paul and with Will Steffen and John McNeil and people like that, you know, that there had been this enormous growth in almost everything. You know, the post-war boom, you know, the trente glorieuse, as they call it in France, you know, of economic growth and development and globalization, industrialization of all sorts. And all kinds of signals did a sharp uptick or even began completely. You know, plastics pretty well began completely as a global signal from the mid-20th century. The rate of carbon emissions zoomed, you know, from their rates of biological change, you know, the future fossils, rates of species invasions and so on. You know, also, you know, there was a marked, you know, upwards tick, you know, in these things. And so it didn't take us long once we discovered this mid-20th century to say, well, that works. And then it became a case of saying, okay, within that general, let's say, decade or so, you know, you need a precise level. Where should that be? You know, we had the initial idea of making it cheap and quick and simple and picking the first atomic bomb explosion, you know, the, you know, Oppenheimer's Trinity explosion, and saying, okay, that marks the beginning. And that would work, but it would be a point in time. It would be a time marker. It would be a local physical marker.
It would be a GSSA.
It would be a GSSA, yes, you know, a global standard stratigraphic age, you know, which is used for deep time way back in the Precambrian. But for the past half billion years, you know, since the beginning of the Cambrian, all of the time markers, you know, which formally mark the beginnings of geological time units, are these GSSPs, the golden spikes, in effect, physical levels at one point, you know, and at one level in strata, which is then used as a reference point, you know, for that time boundary all around the world.
But there was something very attractive about the idea of July 16th, 1945, that Oppenheimer beheld the bomb and conjured up the Bhagavad Gita and talking about destroyer of worlds. It was the start of the nuclear age, and that the nuclear age is in a certain very real sense, kind of congruent with the age of humanity, like the Anthropocene transformation geologically of the entire surface of the planet and the atmosphere, the huge kind of human impact global, that it's kind of, in a certain sense, it's congruent with the age of within which that began with the human discovery that you could split the atom.
Yes, yes. I mean, in many senses, it would work. And you know, if you like, practically, there's no doubt about that. You know, as an instant, you know, it's a historically significant instant, you know, which is part, you know, of the great cavalcade of changes, you know, which brought about, if you like, the Anthropocene world, the Anthropocene Earth. But again, you know, there were points about it which troubled some people. You know, the very precise association with nuclear weapons and nuclear war, you know, was troubling, you know, for some people.
Politically speaking?
I feel like socio-politically speaking, or even more spiritually speaking, you know, to some people, to some of our colleagues, it was quite off-putting, you know, to mark the boundary with something so overtly destructive. The, you know, the nitrogen emissions, the carbon emissions and so on, you know, all of those, you know, are destructive, largely in their own ways. But nonetheless, there was disquiet because nuclear power has a particular, if you like, fear factor, you know, in society at large, you know, which extends into the scientific world. That was probably one reason why we didn't pursue that particular idea. But really, the main reason why it wasn't pursued, was not so much that, but simply it was not a GSSP. You know, it was a GSSA, as you said. And in terms of normal stratigraphic practice, GSSPs are on the up, and GSSAs are being slowly replaced by GSSPs where that is possible.
Okay, so in the end, the Anthropocene Working Group decided to go with the GSSP, with the Golden Spike, and you conducted a search. You selected a dozen candidate sites and assessed them, and Crawford Lake, Ontario won. But the primary signature amongst various signatures within these sedimentary cores is plutonium.
Yes, of course. Yes, it is still the sharpest signal. It's not, you know, probably the very first, you know, explosion, because the signal for that, although it is remarkably widespread, especially in North America, it's not such a global signal as is, you know, the beginning of the thermonuclear tests, you know, the really big atmospheric tests that pushed plutonium up in the stratosphere so then it could settle down across the whole Earth. And that is still, if you like, the sharpest time marker. It's not, of course, the most significant environmental signal. Carbon is probably the winner for that, hands down. But there's, as you said, there's nitrogen, phosphorus, you know, there's all the different biosphere changes and so on. But because we're talking about a time unit and the need for a time marker, then that signal in the early 1950s, you know, from the HMOND tests, you know, is still the clearest time marker.
Okay, so you established the geological reality of the Anthropocene. You established when the base of this geochronological time unit, when it would be. It would be in the mid-1950s. You still have to decide, is it 1950 or 51 or 52, based on an analysis of the Crawford Lake core.
Yes.
So that's yet to be announced. It'll be interesting to know. The third issue was, how do you classify this new time period? Is it going to be just an age, or is it going to be an epoch? And the question that comes to my mind that I ask is, what's the significance of it being declared an epoch? Because this is what the Anthropocene Working Group would end up proposing and is proposing, will propose this fall to the SQS, that it be classed as ranked as an epoch. What is an epoch?
Epoch, it's not an enormously, if you like, large time unit, you know, as is, you know, an aeon or an era or even a period, you know, in that, you know, it's the second up, if you like, in the hierarchy. So it's bigger than an age, but smaller than a period. The Holocene is an epoch. You know, it's one of two epochs in the Quaternary period. It would mean truncating, as it were, stopping, you know, the Holocene, you know, at whatever time is suggested by the boundary, you know, sometime in the mid 20th century, you know, and having the Anthropocene then succeeding the Holocene.
So, I mean, if this were to be accepted by the SQS and the International Commission on Stratigraphy and eventually the IUGS next year in Busan, Korea, if this, the whole package were to be accepted and the IUGS would declare, yes, the Holocene is over and the Anthropocene has begun, why would this matter to ordinary people? Would this be a wake-up call? Would this be a shock? What is it about the Holocene being over that really matters concretely and tangibly for life on this planet, human life on the planet, for sure?
Once we start talking at that kind of level, you know, the, you know, the wider level, you know, as it affects you and me as human beings and, you know, all our colleagues and the societies around us, then that distinction would reflect the scale of the environmental change that has taken place in this brief time, you know, this one human lifetime of the Anthropocene. You know, so that is, if you like, the degree, scale and speed of climate change, of biospheric change, you know, of increases in surface nitrogen, phosphorus, you know, which have all kinds of, you know, ecological effects.
I mean, human civilization emerged in the Holocene. Human civilization, as we know it, is adapted to Holocene conditions, which are essentially climatic conditions. It's a climatic envelope. So if the Holocene's over and the Anthropocene's begun, we're in a new epoch. Watch out.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, what it's suggesting that, you know, this thing is large and, you know, it is changing the Earth system, you know, the whole manner in which the Earth works in a rapid and significant way. So yes, climate is changing. We now have an atmosphere which is, in terms of greenhouse gas content, has not been seen for the 2.5 million years of the Quaternary, last seen, you know, 3 million years ago in the Pliocene, or perhaps even going on for 10 million years ago in the Miocene. You know, it's those kinds of comparisons are now being made. And of course, you know, the Earth's heat balance is catching up, and there is still a good deal of warming in the pipeline, even if carbon emissions stop today, you know, because the Earth's heat balance has got to catch up, you know, with its, you know, the new thickness of the blanket, you know, around our planet.
And Jim Hansen is proposing something in a paper you may be familiar with that's still being assessed, in which he's saying that there is as much as 10 degrees warming in the pipeline.
Yes. I'm very aware of that paper. He's, you know, that is at the upper end of the kind of estimates that are being made. But even with the lesser degrees of heating, the more conservative degrees, you know, proposed by, you know, the IPCC in their reports, you know, and others, it's still, you know, a very substantial change, you know, to the Earth's climate, you know, which is almost year by year now intensifying, you know, and say forming a new climate. And of course, climate change is only part of the changes of the Anthropocene. Indeed, when we first started work, you know, and particularly when Paul Crutzen first proposed it, the idea, one could then say that climate change was an incipient part, you know, of the whole catalogue of Anthropocene characters. Well, you know, a decade or two later, it's no longer incipient. It is clearly now changing rapidly and significantly. So we're dealing with a moving target, but nonetheless, one that is moving rapidly, you know, and at a large scale. So yes, an epoch to us, simply on geological terms, seems justified. As Paul Crutzen suggested, you know, the Holocene is not a good description for the kind of world we live in today. Now, that idea of truncating the Holocene, stopping it, is uncomfortable for a number of my stratigraphic colleagues, you know, my professional stratigraphic colleagues, you know, working within their own particular sphere.
Indeed it is. Geologists have in the past, of course, declared, pinpointed the start of new ages, new stages, the smallest time units in their own lifetimes. Geologists have never declared the start of a new epoch in their own lifetimes. And this really troubles geologists who say that it's no business of geologists to be declaring the start of new epochs in their own lifetimes, you know, that began just 70 years ago.
Yes, yes, it is, I think, to a number of my colleagues, you know, it feels very alien kind of concept, you know, it's, and as you said, uncomfortable, you know, perhaps even science fiction-ish. But the evidence suggests, you know, this is really happening and this kind of geology is forming, and one can describe this new kind of geology in old-fashioned classical terms as one does for the Pleistocene and the Jurassic and the Cambrian, and make comparisons. And on the basis of those comparisons, epoch-level change already seems justified.
But others would say, folks like Phil Gibbard and others say, oh, it's just a blip. Could well be just a blip. We should wait and see.
It's clearly not a blip. And I think, again, this is part of the peril of being in this kind of terrain. There are several ways in which it's not a blip. You know, you can't go back. Let's say if you put your foot on the brake, you know, the Holocene world won't reappear. Whether you take Jim Hansen's view or the IPCC view or whatever, climate is set to carry on changing beyond Holocene norms for thousands of years, you know, and will prevent glaciation, you know, for many tens of thousands of years already. And in terms of things like, you know, the biosphere changes, you know, so the number of the thousands of species transplanted between every ocean and every continent, you know, the already large number of extinctions. It's not a mass extinction event yet, but it's a mass transplantation event, which is permanently reconfiguring the Earth's biology. It's scrambling biogeographic patterns, which have been around for many, many millions of years. And this new biological omelet, you know, that has been created, is of course the basis for all future biology. Evolution will take place from this new baseline, and future biology and future paleontology, therefore, also will be controlled by this. So, it's not a blip.
Jan Zalesiewicz is an emeritus professor of paleobiology at the University of Leicester and a member of the Anthropocene Working Group. Sometime this fall, the working group will submit its proposal to a sub-commission of the International Commission on Stratigraphy. Listen to my complete conversation with Jan Zalesiewicz at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and the Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
This is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.